Right, good afternoon, everybody. So today there's no lecture handout because we're going to carry on with the same lecture handout that I gave out on Tuesday, and today hopefully get to the end of that. And on Tuesday, I introduced the notion of the relational model of databases, and in particular the notion of a schema. And today, a schema for the relational model. Today what we're going to do is we're going to look at how to translate the entity relationship diagrams from the from last Friday's lecture into a relational schema in the data definition language of SQL. So basically, we start with an ER diagram, and the idea is we want to, from our ER diagram, find a way of producing a relational schema, that is giving a definition in the data definition language of SQL. Is the microphone working? Well, it's turned on. If it's not working, then there won't be any sound on the video recording of the lecture. So I'm sorry about that. I mean, it should be working. Everything's... Anyway, well, I'll speak as loud as I can. So what we're going to do is start with a diagram where we want basically rules to translate that to a schema. And these rules are essentially going to be automatic. And they're automatic in the sense that you can even build a tool that, using the rules that I'm going to describe now, will take an ER diagram and automatically from that produce a relational schema that corresponds to it. So there's an automatic way of going from entity relationship diagrams to schemas. But in fact, those tools also make decisions along the way, because there are, as we'll see, there are occasionally alternative choices that can be made in how to translate an ER diagram. And there are also issues that the translation is, in a sense, approximate, because sometimes there are constraints in the diagram that don't then get translated into the relational schema. So sometimes it's not easy or sensible to implement all constraints in the diagram. And conversely, on other occasions, sometimes it's possible in the relational schema to implement constraints that are in the scenario, but for which it's hard to represent in the diagram. So the two models don't exactly match, but they're close enough. And in practice, ER diagrams are a good tool for the design of databases, because they give this nice way of visualizing data, as you'll also see in the tutorial exercises for next week. So in practice, they're a nice way of visualizing the constraints on the scenario, and they're a useful tool for these kind of methods. Actually really do suffice in practice for going from a design into a schema. Right, so the first parts are going to essentially review what we did on Tuesday, but in the slightly different format of this time. We're starting with the ER diagram, and we're going to automatically apply the rules. I'm going to tell you what the rules are, and we'll see how they generate the relational schema. So the simplest thing is just how to translate an entity set. So to do that, we want to say what the schema corresponding to an entity set is. Remember, the schema gives the name of the table, together with the information about the fields in the table, the corresponding to the attributes, and also the types associated with those fields. So what the kind of data we're storing in the attributes. So the algorithm here is very simple. We've got the entity set of students. We simply create a table for that entity set. We make each attribute of the entity set, so there are four here, the matriculation number, the name, the age, and the email, into a field of the table, and we give it a type that's appropriate to that kind of attribute. And then we want to also say, here we've identified the matriculation number as the primary key, so we also want to put that information in as the key constraint in the table, in the schema. So here we get just exactly the same schema we had in the last lecture, but we now see we've got to it by applying these rules on the previous slide. So we say create table, we give the name of the relationship of the entity set, we give the names of the fields corresponding to the names of the attributes, we give them appropriate types, so age is an integer, name and email are character strings. Matriculation number we've decided to implement as a character string here. And we say what the primary key is here, the matriculation number. Incidentally, one thing I didn't say last week, on Tuesday, was why there are brackets around the primary key here. But a key is always a tuple. That means it's a number of fields separated by commas. And in a special case, there's just a single field in the key. So in that case, you still have the brackets for a tuple, but there's only one thing that occurs inside it. So the brackets are because keys are tuples, and here it's just a single entry in that tuple. Okay, so entity sets are straightforward. I mean, we've already seen this data definition language declaration already, yes? Sorry? So an integer will, an implementation of SQL will have an associated integer size associated with it. Yeah, so there'll be a maximum integer you can have. If that's, is that what you're asking?
Well,
okay, well, sometimes you can specify a range on integers, but as I said in the last lecture, we're only going to consider only a few types in this course. So the types we're going to consider are integer, meaning arbitrary integer. We won't concern ourselves what the maximum integer is or a range of integers. We'll just say integer. And character strings of a specified length. And there might have been another one or two. I don't remember. We'll see as we go along. Is there another question as well? I thought I saw somebody else's hand up. Okay, so that's entity sets. So in the case of a relationship, when we don't have any constraints on the relationship. So here we've got the takes relationship. So again, we create, so in the relational model, the only thing we have is relations. So we don't have a distinction between entity sets and relationships. Everything has to be a table. So everything for all kinds of relationships and entity sets, we need to declare a schema for a table. So we declare a table for the relationship set again. And now, for the fields, this time we, rather than adding all the fields in the picture, we add those fields that are that correspond to the attributes specifically attached to the relationship. So in that case, that's just the attribute for Mark. And we also add the fields corresponding to the participating entity sets, so here students and courses, that give us the primary keys of those entity sets. So in this case, we need the primary key of the students table, that's the matriculation number, and the primary key of the courses table. So we declare that then the primary key of a member of the relationship table. Well, a member of the relationship table needs to say which student is related to which course. So we need to combine the primary key of the primary keys of the participating table of the participating entity set tables in order to form the primary key of the participating relationship table. And then we need to tell SQL where these keys come from. So we need to say these fields, on the one hand, index reference the students in the student table, and on the other hand, reference the courses in the courses table. And we do that using the foreign key constraints that we already saw on Tuesday. So the final code, and this code was already in the slides on Tuesday, but now we see how we're obtaining this code by applying these algorithms for going from the entity relationship diagram to the relational schema. So the final code says, well, we're creating the table for the takes relationship. We indeed here have the two fields corresponding to the primary keys of the students and courses table, respectively, matriculation number and code. We also have the fields corresponding to the extra attribute that the takes relationship has, that's the mark. So our primary key now combines the two. So as I said, keys are tuples in general. So here the primary key is a tuple, which is the pair consisting of matriculation number and the code, so the two participating tables. And we need to say, well, the foreign key references the student's table. So the matriculation number comes from the student's table, that's using foreign key, and the code references the courses table. That's again done using a foreign key constraint. And just to remind you what I said on Tuesday about how SQL implements these constraints. So the point of these constraints in the code is that you're actually putting constraints on the what are called integrity constraints on the data in the database, making sure that the data in the database, SQL will ensure that the data in the database fulfills the criteria that are implemented in these constraints. So the primary key constraint will make sure that you SQL will not allow you to insert two different rows into the takes table, so the table for the takes relationship, that relate the same, that combine the same student and the same course. We're only allowed to say a particular student takes a particular, John Smith, say, takes a particular course, informatics, one data and analysis, say. We're only allowed to say that once. And that's obviously an important constraint. Well, if we said it twice, it would violate the primary key constraint. That's why SQL forbids it. But it's an important constraint because that prevents us from giving inconsistent marks to the same student for the same course. We can only give the student one mark for the course. The foreign key constraint makes sure that when we insert an entry into the takes relationship, saying John Smith takes informatics 1 data and analysis, this foreign key constraint saying that John Smith comes from the students table, well, of course, we're referring to him by his matriculation number, but it will check to make sure that that matriculation number really does refer to a student in the students table. Otherwise, SQL won't allow us to insert this entry into the takes table. And in the same way, SQL will check that the code we give for the Informatics 1 Data and Analysis course really does correspond to the course in the courses table. Okay, so these constraints are making sure that SQL implements the constraints that we want the database to satisfy. Okay, so now we come to the slightly more tricky task of how to deal with the constraints that we've put in an entity relationship diagram, such as key constraints and participation constraints, and these sorts of things. How are we going to deal with these in the SQL DDL declaration, data definition language declaration of relational schemas? So here's a case of mapping relationship set. So we've already seen how to map a relationship, but the difference here is we know this directed by relationship has a key constraint. Namely, so remember the key constraint was that every student has at most one directory of studies, and that's the arrow part here. There's also the bold line here, which is that every student has exactly one directory of studies, but for the moment we're just implementing the key constraint part, that's the arrow part, the at most one part, rather than the participation constraint, the exactly one part. So to do that, well, just as before, when we were doing the takes relationship, we create a table for the relationship set. Again, we add all the primary keys of the participating entity sets as fields of the table, just as we did before. So we would add the matriculation number as a field here for the primary key for the students, and the staff ID here, which is the primary key for the director of studies table. Again, we would add a field for each attribute of the relationship. Here, there aren't actually any specific attributes that are directed by relationship. So in this case, we don't do anything here. But that's the general algorithm, is to add a field for each attribute of the relationship. We then declare a primary key, and this is the place that it differs from the treatment of a general relationship. For a relationship with a key constraint, because we have this constraint that having the student determines the director of studies, then the student's identity, it's the matriculation number of the student, is itself a key for this relationship. Because to find the director of studies, it's enough to have the student's matriculation number. So in this case, we can declare the primary key using just the key field from what's called the source entity, rather than, that's the one on the left of the arrow, on the source side of the arrow, rather than the one on the target side of the arrow. And again, we need to declare the foreign key constraints as before, saying the directed by relationship, the student's field is coming from the student's table, and the director of studies field is coming from the director of studies table. So that's wrapped up in the following definition here. So we've got matriculation number, so the two fields, the corresponding to the primary keys of both tables, But this time we just say the primary key of the directed by relationship is just the primary key of the student's table. So just the matriculation number field here. Okay. But one thing that this doesn't do is it does capture the key constraint. So the key constraint is captured via this primary key declaration here, saying that the matriculation number is enough to determine the DOS. That enforces in SQL that you can't, that prevents us in SQL from adding two different entries to the directed by table for the same student, because that would violate the primary key constraint here. But this doesn't implement the participation constraint. So this, using this directed by table here, we've got no way in SQL of saying that, well, not with the simple SQL that we're going to consider in this course, we don't have a good way of saying that every student has a director of studies. So every student from the students table will participate in this relationship. And that requires a different kind of approach. So in fact, when I said at the beginning that the rules are automatic, you see that essentially we're giving an algorithm for going from the entity relationship diagram. So we're giving a procedure for going from the entity relationship diagram into the SQL data definition language declaration of schemas. But there are choices to be made, as I said, and here's an example of where there's a choice. So when you've got key constraints, there is a different way of doing the translation. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's not. But anyway, for the moment, I'll just present the second method and you can see how it compares. So the second approach is not to have a table for the directed by relationship at all. So instead of that, we have, as before, a table for the students and the students' entity set, and a table for the director of studies entity set. But this time we're going to put the directed by information into the students' table. Because each student has at most one director of studies, we can add another field to the students' table and say, call it director of studies, and we can say in an entry for a student, as part of their basic information, rather than having it in a separate table, as part of their basic information, we'll say the director of studies of this student, a field there, is this particular director. Okay, so what we do is we just create the tables for the entity set, as before. We don't create one for the relationship. We add the primary key field. So the new thing we do is we add the primary key field of the target, that's the director of studies here, to the student's table, and we need to declare that field as a foreign key in the student's table. So it says here, this does slightly pollute the student's entity table, and what that means is, well, in our diagram, we'd said what the attributes are that we think of as the basic data associated with students, and director of studies wasn't one of them. Director of studies was in this relationship. Now by was in having the relationship here. Now by instead of making a table for the relationship, putting the director of studies into the student's table, we're polluting the student's table in the sense that we're incorporating their information that we had not in our diagram identified as primary information associated with the student. So there's that sort of pollution going on with respect to our original entity relationship design. But still, sometimes this is a useful technique because sometimes it's the efficient way of implementing a relationship with a key constraint. Anyway, so here's the definition. The important thing, the director of studies entity set is just dealt with as before, but now we create a new table for students, and it's exactly as before, except that we've incorporated as an extra field the DOS identity, that's the primary key from the director of studies table. And then, of course, we need to declare that that is a foreign key because that references the director of studies. Okay. And once again, when you add a student entry to the table, so information about a particular student, John Smith, say, and we add that information, then when we add the DOS identity number as the information associated with this field in that row of the table, SQL will check that that really does correspond to the primary key of the director of studies that exists in the director of studies table. That's how SQL verifies this, this foreign key constraint. Okay, so now, because again the matriculation number is the primary key, we can only have one row for each student, so we only have a way of having one director of studies associated with each student. So we've implemented the key constraint in that way. But in fact, this does not implement the participation constraint. It does not enforce us to give a director of studies to every student for a subtle reason that I wonder if anybody knows what the reason is. There are two different ways you might know what this reason is. One is that you might have experience with SQL already, and there's another way that you might know what this reason is. So, yes? Okay, it shouldn't be empty. There's a proper word for empty in this context.
It shouldn't
be null. So the reason that you might know this concept already is because either you might have experience with SQL, or you might have realized that the answer to the question was going to be on the next slide, which is in front of you. I don't know which your answer was. So have you got experience with SQL? So okay, you're coming from the first point. But anyway, so SQL actually allows you to, when you define entries for a table, you can fill in values for some of the fields. There's a special value called null that you're allowed to fill in some fields. And with this declaration as it is here, there's nothing to stop you adding an entry to the student's table saying John Smith, say matriculation number whatever, name John Smith, age 19, email John Smith at whatever, and the DOS ID, you could say no with this declaration. There's nothing to stop. SQL won't reject that, so we're not implementing the participation relation. So what are these null values? Well, this is a very special value in SQL, because you're allowed to put a null value in. Doesn't matter what the type of the field is, you can elect to put a null value in to register that you don't have a value to put in at this time when you're filling in this field of this particular entry. So in the case of John Smith, Director of Studies, for example, perhaps we haven't yet assigned him a Director of Studies, or the Director of Studies he had before has left, and we still haven't assigned him a new one, so it might be useful to be able to put a null value in. But in fact, the meaning of null can change according to the circumstance, and it's actually quite a controversial subject in SQL, what null should mean and what the logic of dealing with null values is. There are hosts of papers and hosts of theories about this. It's not really relevant to the course, but the sort of thing that is relevant is you might use null to say unknown, the value's unknown, or it's missing, or it's unavailable, or it makes no sense, or various things like this. So null is basically, if you don't have a value you can give, then you might have null to reflect that fact. And null values are allowed to appear in foreign key fields, so that's why here, where the DOS identity, directed by relationship here, implemented in the second way, where the DOS identity is a foreign field, is a foreign key, there's nothing to prevent that from being null. Right, I'd like to correct the slides here. So if you've got the slides in front of you, so it says here some implementations do not allow the null value to appear in primary key fields. Now that's correct, what that says, but really the right thing to say here is the SQL standard says that null values should not appear in primary key fields. So according to true SQL, a primary key field should never be null. It doesn't really make sense to have a primary key being null, because primary keys are supposed to uniquely identify the entry of the table, and a null value is not going to be a very good way of uniquely identifying a row in a table. So that's why the SQL standard says that primary keys should not be null. So the right way of putting this is that the SQL standard says that primary keys should not be null, and some implementations rightly respect this. Other implementations, however, and SQLite is a very well-known example of this, failed to implement this requirement, they failed to check for this requirement that primary keys should not be null. In fact, that was an error in the implementation that they noticed too late, and they never corrected it because they didn't want. So for people who know about SQLite, is an implementation of SQL that's very commonly used, and they didn't want to correct it because then they were worried about having problems with legacy code, people who'd been using the version that didn't have the right checking on null values and primary keys, they didn't want their code not to work, so it never got corrected. Anyway, so the right thing is the standard says primary keys should not be null, but some implementations don't enforce that. Anyway, once we've got the idea of a null value, as I said before, that's the reason the participation constraint perhaps isn't enforced in this definition, but we can enforce it just by adding a not null declaration to the field. So that's done like this. So we have exactly the same definition as before. We've added the DOS identity to the table, and we've said to the students table, just as before, again the primary key is just the matriculation number, so that enforces the key constraint, but adding the requirement that the DOS information must not be null enforces the participation constraint here. So this is one way in which we've got these two approaches to translating key constraints. This is one way in which the second approach is better than the first. The first approach was to have a relationship for the directed, to have a table for the directed by relationship. And the problem with that was that we couldn't enforce the participation constraint. The second approach was to not have a relationship for the directed by field, but instead incorporate that into the student's table. The problem with that was that it pollutes the original idea of the student's table, but the benefit of it is that we can enforce other constraints such as the participation constraint. Now, as I said at the beginning, there are choices to be made. One needs to choose which approach to use. And in fact, in this case, in a real-world database for students, one really might choose not to have this database, this constraint here, this not null constraint, because it might be useful when a student first arrives at the university to put their entry in before their DOS has been assigned, or to allow for the transition phase if a student changes director of studies. So it might actually be better not to enforce this and then just use queries to check which students don't have directors of studies afterwards, but not to require whenever you have a student entry that it always has a director of studies associated. Okay, so we've just got two more things to translate now. We've got the notion of weak entity set and the notion of hierarchical entity set. So weak entity sets are rather similar to the second approach to translating key constraints, and that's because a weak entity set always comes with... So remember, the weak entity set was when you had an identifying owner entity set here, buildings, and then the rooms entities required knowledge of the building in order to be able to uniquely identify a room, because the room is not enough to specify the room number, but we also need to give the name of the building. So because the weak entity sets always come with a key constraint that also has total participation on it, then we can basically apply the same approach that we had before for the key constraints with total participation. So we again create a table this time for the weak entity set, and we make each attribute of the weak entity set a field of the table, and just as in the case of the key plus participation constraint, the second approach we've just seen, we add the field for the primary key of the identifying owner as a foreign key constraint in this table. And then one other thing we do is we then add a funny instruction here to instruct the system to automatically delete any tuples in the table for which there are no owners. So that's all done on this subsequent slide. This funny instruction here, that I said about instructing the system to delete entries that don't have identified owners. This is this on-delete cascade, and I'm going to explain this in a little bit more detail on the board. So this is somewhere that I'd like you to take notes and put them in the space for notes on the lecture slides. So I'll put the lights on and we'll... oh, this doesn't work. And let's use the central board. Whoops, wrong one. Right, so the issue here So the issue here is the following. Suppose we have an entry such as, so remember, entries in the database correspond to rows in a table. The schema defines the shape of a table, the number of columns in the table. So the fields we've got are each of the columns. So we've got three entries here, the number, the capacity, and the building name. And an entry will be a row in the table, so it will have a room number, in this case, LT3. Fortunately, yeah, so it's allowed to be an eight character string. So this is actually, it's Lecture Theatre 1. Why don't we have Lecture Theatre 1? Capacity 200, I guess. And the building name, well, code here, Appleton Tower. So suppose this is an entry in the rooms table. And because this is a foreign key here, there must be an entry. So there must be a corresponding entry, AT entry, in the, so SQL will enforce this in the buildings table. So here this might be AT for the building, Appleton Tower, and the address, say if the address is the other field, I seem to remember, would be 1 Crichton Street. Now what this entry here, what this foreign key constraint here, this on-delete cascade is doing in the rooms declaration, it's saying it's addressing the question, what does SQL do if the university removes this entry, the AT entry, from the buildings table? So suppose AT is removed from the buildings table. For example, suppose they demolish the building, which is something that many people in Edinburgh have been hoping for about 40 years, ever since Appleton Tower was built, that it would be demolished. I think it was once listed in the top 10 ugliest buildings in the UK, within the last 10 years. Anyway. But what concerns us now is, what does SQL do? So the university has demolished the building. So this has been removed from the buildings table. But what does SQL do? Because this now violates the foreign key constraint that says that AT must correspond to an entry in the buildings table. It doesn't anymore. So there's a choice of what SQL might do. And this is why, so when you declare a foreign key, you're allowed to say, to tell SQL what to do. And there are three options that I'm going to cover in this course. So you say on delete, and you tell SQL what to do. So cascade, which is what we say here, says SQL removes the entry in with the foreign key. So in this case, if the university removed Appleton Tower from the database, then from the rooms table, all the rooms in Appleton Tower would also be removed automatically. That's what Cascade is saying. And that's considered the right thing to do with weak entity sets, because a weak entity set is subservient to its defining entity set. Okay, so the primary thing is the defining entity set, and it's considered right with a weak entity set that that the system should automatically remove dependent things. Okay, so that's what we do for weak entity sets. But I just want to tell you what two of the other options are. So one is no action, and with this one, SQL refuses to remove AT from the buildings table while there are 80 rooms in the rooms table. Okay, and this is actually the default. So when you specify a foreign key constraint, SQL by default will apply the no action policy for if you remove the owner, if you try to remove an entry for which there is a foreign key, then SQL will reject that. And the final one is set null. There are several more, but the final one that you might be examined on in this course is set null. And what that does is, well, if we remove the Appleton Tower entry here from the rooms table, well, it just sets the field that doesn't make sense anymore. Would get set to null, which is of course totally inappropriate to this situation, because it wouldn't make sense to have lecture theatre 1 capacity 200 in building null. So that's just not appropriate. Yeah. But just to say that these are the three options for when you specify a foreign key. Okay, any questions about that? Maybe, is it okay if I leave this up here and just carry on with this slide, or would you prefer to have the central slide back? Who'd like the central slide back? Who'd like the board left where it is? Okay, pretty much apathy, I would say. So in that case, I'll leave this here for 2 minutes and then I'll put the other slide back. How about that? Just in case anyone's copying it down. So the last thing is the mapping of hierarchical entities. Let's put the lights down a little bit. Okay, so this is the case in which we had the students table and we had the two subclasses of it, the full-time students and the part-time students. And for this, it's very simple. All we need to do, we declare the table as usual for the superclass, which is the students table here. We declare another table for each of the subclasses. So we declare another table for full-time students, another table for part-time students.
I mean, we'd use the primary key from the superclasses table for the subclass tables. And we would, of course, declare that as a foreign key because the information about the students is still coming from the superclass students table. And finally, we need to add to each of the subclass tables any additional attributes as a field that are associated just with the subclass. So here the part-time fraction. So it's actually,
you do exactly what you would expect. And
so here we're just, here's just an example of the part-time students. We don't need to have the various fields name and email from the students table because they're accessible through the students table. So we just add the matriculation number as the primary key here. The part-time fraction is the additional field that we need. And we need to say that the primary key is coming as a foreign key from the students table.
Okay, so that's basically the whole process that, as in so far as we're going to consider it, of translating an entity relationship diagram into an SQL schema, a set of SQL schemas in the data definition language. As I said, this is often an automated process, but you've seen in the lecture that there are places within which you can make design decisions, some of which might be better depending on, for example, whether you're more concerned with keeping the relationships pure in the sense of not being polluted, but corresponding to the primary attribute collections that you've identified in the entity relationship diagram, or whether you're more concerned with practical matters like implementing participation constraints that we saw in some cases could only be done by, in a sense, polluting the tables, for example, the students' table, with other attributes. So there are choices to be made, but still, overall, you can see that underlying it is a very almost mechanical procedure to translate an entity relationship diagram into SQL schemata. Okay, are there any questions on that? So tutorials start on Tuesday next week. I hope everyone's now seen that the exercise has been released. Please do check the course blog regularly to see what's going on in the course. And that's basically it. We're finishing pleasantly early today.
I just have one question regarding when we can find the video log of the lectures from this year.
The what, sorry?
The video log from the lectures this year. You said that they are being videoed?
Yeah, I look into that.
I looked at the website and couldn't find any direct links here from last year's, so that's why I'm asking.
I think there's a link off the Informatics One website.
Okay. I'll try to.
But I'll put one on the course website
okay.
as well.
Thank you very
yeah,
much.
Okay. But I haven't done that yet. Thank you. Yeah, sure. Oh, this is the tutorial.
Yeah. Yeah. But I know, I'm just done.
Yeah.
So if I do a single line, thin single line, that means it's all, it's like everyone's participating, you know what I mean? Single lines, you know, bold lines partial participation.
No, it's the other way around. Bold line is total participation. So,
oh,
so the bold arrow says,
brilliant.
So that says every designer.
So
the bold line says every designer has some poster that they create,
mm-hmm.
and but here we're saying, yeah, right, and the arrow says that there's exactly one poster. Every designer. So bold arrow is every designer has exactly one poster they create.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
But you might have a look at why does this have a double border here?
Because I thought that the best way to have a primary key for the poster would be, I know it's got a session and each day is different, but I thought maybe it would be better if it was related to the ID number, because then you're specific with ID number and stamp.
Well, so if you've got so you're trying to define a weekend, so it's a week relationship.
Yeah.
But if you have that, you need to have, if you were making that a week. So weak relationship only makes sense if there's a weak entity set associated with it. So you need also an entity set with a double line around it. And it needs to be the thing on the left, it needs to be the thing in the source of the arrow. So if you're trying to do this, you would be saying that the design part of the information designer has to include the poster ID. So I think you'll get yourself into trouble.
Okay, so this should be the one. Okay. That's
So the configurations you're allowed, I mean, you're allowed relationship. So if you've got a relationship like this, so you can do what you want, but this could be an arrow, that means every one of these has a post one of these, or it could be a bold line, every one of these has at least one of these, or it could be a bold line together with an arrow, which is every one of these has exactly one of these. But a weak entity set, the only configuration you're allowed for defining a weak entity set is you have to have a bold arrow, then this has to be the weak entity set of the arrow. And so you see if that makes sense. And this only makes sense if, in order to give ID information here, to give a key here, you don't have enough information.
Is there any way that you can say that there's no relationship between them and the designer, so the judge cannot be a designer? Is there any way that you can do that? Like drawing it? Or is there a symbol in it? Like, is that in the reading then?
Have a look at